Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
Hi, Bomb Squad. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. Each week, we talk to the most interesting women in the world of food and bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life. If you're listening live, you're probably like, what is going on? Sorry, I was a little late to the studio. A poor guy had a seizure on my train. It was awful. You read about things like that happening, but then it actually happens. And the only bright spot, well, two bright spots, by the time the EMS got there, which took like a lifetime, he was conscious and breathing, which was great. And we happened to pull into a train station that has a police station in it, Hoyt Skimmerhorn. So thank you, Hoyt Skimmerhorn Station. I had to run and go grab a police officer while the other passengers on the train stayed with him. And, you know, bizarrely, I'm looking at Vanessa, who's our guest, as I talk about this. I made the decision a few days ago to not wear heels anymore because I was like, it's such a weird world right now, and I feel like you never know when you're going to have to bolt. Yeah. And I was so grateful I wasn't wearing stupid shoes as I, like, bolted up the subway stairs. So anyway, sorry. We're not going to have any high heel sponsors anytime soon for Radio Cherry Bomb, but that's okay. So anyway, it's very nice to be back on the studio. I was on the road for several weeks for our Future of Food tour. I visited Atlanta, Nashville, Portland, Denver, Minneapolis, and I had such a great time. We recorded all the talks and panels, I didn't do it personally, on each stop, and we'll be broadcasting those later this summer. Thank you so much to Kerry Gold, the makers of that awesome butter, and to Masi Agricola Wines for their support so we could hit the road and visit the Bomb Squad across the country. One of the big highlights is when I was in Minneapolis, I had the privilege of interviewing Lynn Rosetto Casper, who was the host of the Splendid Table radio show for more than 20 years. I've admired Lynn for a long time, so I was really excited and a bit nervous, as you probably heard if you listened, to interview her. We aired that podcast last week, so be sure to listen if you missed it. You know, it was quite a long time to be on the road and back and forth and not being at home and in your own bed. And we're going to talk later about one event that hit me particularly hard, and I know it hit you too, the death of Anthony Bourdain. If you listen to the show, you know who Anthony was. I mean, the whole world knows who Anthony was. An amazing writer, host, and producer of the groundbreaking food and travel show, Parts Unknown, which brought him everywhere from the Mississippi Delta to Myanmar. We're going to be talking more about Anthony during the second part of the show, and we have some special guests who are calling in. Let's thank our sponsors for making Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you're daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplome, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that has been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today. Today's first guest is Vanessa Palacio. She is the owner and culinary director of Chicha Cafetin. Is
that Cafetin.
Cafetin and cocktails. Obviously, I didn't get to do my pre-interview with Vanessa out in the green room. Chicha is a Nicaraguan restaurant in Bushwick. Vanessa was born in Brooklyn. She's one of those rare, not just a New York native, but a Brooklyn native. She and her husband, Adam, opened their first business in New York City in the Lower East Side. It was called Little Munster. And if you, am I saying Munster right?
We How said Munster here, but we definitely Munster. Had some Germans and that would be like Munster.
I mean, I love grilled cheese, so I thought it was the coolest thing that there was a grilled cheese sandwich restaurant. Vanessa, though, wanted to explore the cuisine of Nicaragua, so she spent years researching and developing recipes with her mother and grandmother. She and Adam opened their pop-up restaurant, opened a pop-up restaurant in 2014 called Little Nica, right?
Yes.
And that paved the way for Chicha, which opened recently. The menu was inspired by traditional Nicaraguan roadside cafes. So, Vanessa, I know you just talked earlier. Could be that was your trial run. So, if you're listening live, you get to hear Vanessa twice. So, lucky you. But Vanessa, thanks for putting up with the chaos today, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Problem. Thank you for having me.
And my pleasure. All right, let's start with Chicha. When did it open?
So we opened May 2018. We've had a good 5-week run so far.
And you're still standing. You're not
yes.
in tears like I was when I opened my first place. How's it going?
It's amazing. It's so fantastic to have a full service restaurant serving food that I grew up eating. It is kind of a dream come true. I never thought that the stuff that like my mom was serving and, you know, at home would be what I'm serving to other people. And it's new to so many people. Nicaraguan cuisine is not very well known.
No. And I looked up Nicaraguan restaurants, New York City restaurants, and you always assume you can get anything in New York. But I feel like the last Nicaraguan restaurant that existed closed a few years ago.
I'm not even familiar with that restaurant, but because I was saying earlier that I think we might be the only Nicaraguan restaurant north of Miami.
Wow. Which, why is that?
I think up until this point, they, you know, Nicaragua wasn't as well known for a long time in the community of Nicaraguans. The number is in the thousands, obviously, here in New York, but it's not as large as it is in Miami. And it was something that wasn't really explored up here.
So your parents are first generation?
I'm first generation.
You're first generation.
Yeah.
And so your parents immigrated here?
When I was born,
okay.
Yeah.
And you grew up with your parents and your grandparents? I feel like I read about a grandmother somewhere.
So my grandparents, I mean, I don't know if this is Latin families, but my grandparents, I mean, they could have been my parents anyways. We saw them constantly. My parents owned a business with my grandparents as well. So they were in the supermarket industry. And
what
so
does that mean?
They owned the Key Food in Brooklyn Heights.
Oh, wow.
So I was seeing them.
Key Foods.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I kind of grew up in there too. So food was always around us. I mean, it was like in our life and just my grandfather, the reason I got into restaurants was because of my grandfather. He used to like going all to the steakhouses and he would take my brother, my sister and I, and we'd get steaks. And if my brother got a larger one at Peter Luger's or Sparks or whatever, I would be like, I want one as large as he has. So
they would literally serve him the larger of the steaks?
I think
when
so.
You ordered the same thing?
I think so. I don't think it would be like that today.
No, that's sexist. So who was cooking at home?
Both my parents.
Okay.
I think they worked really well as a team. I would say that my father was more of the like hard cooker, and this is kind of how my husband and I too. Like he does more of the grilling and the frying and stuff, and I do a lot of the prep and seasoning. I come in as like the closer and you know make sure that
you
the dish
the
is
seasoning.
Excellent.
No one has ever said that before on the show. That's hilarious. So let's jump straight ahead to what Nicaraguan cuisine actually is, because I don't know. A lot of people don't know. I'm totally coming to Chicha next week, but tell me what's on the menu.
Okay, so most people that now know Nicaragua and think about it, they say gallo pinto, our rice and beans dish, which is superb. I love it. But it's a lot of corn-based food. are like typical dishes called like nacatamal. It's made out of cornmeal and has meat and some vegetables inside wrapped in plantain leaves. There's also like another dish called indio viejo that's based out of a corn masa as well. Depending on what coast you are on, there's like seafood on the East Coast is very popular, and same with coconut. So they have a soup called rondong, which is a lovely seafood stew with coconut and everything, and it's delicious. On the Pacific Coast, where my family's from, again, a lot of meat and chicken, and then a few, on the coastline, seafood. There's a freshwater lake, one of the largest lakes in the world, and there's like excellent seafood coming out of there. There's this fish called a huapote, which is, means the handsome one, and it's a dish that they serve fried, and it's beautifully presented, and it's just like everyone goes to the city called Granada, which is located on the lake, to eat this fish.
I heard parts of Nicaragua are really, really beautiful, and unfortunately we don't really hear about that in America because there's been so much political unrest over the years, and that's what the media tends to focus on.
Yeah, and unfortunately right now there's a lot of political unrest going on, so it's not in the news as much as I think as Nicaraguans would like to see. But yes, Nicaragua is a beautiful country. It's called the Land of Volcanoes, which part of our restaurant, we got all of our wood made down there and sent up. And part on the wall, there's this like a wood slat wall that's supposed to represent the volcanoes, that they're like triangles. And it's beautiful lagoons. The beaches are pristine. I mean, it's not a very well-traveled country yet, so it's everything is still pretty much as it should be.
Did you visit much as a kid?
So we started going back when I was 13, and then after that, we'd go back 2-3 times a year. My parents, pretty much up until this point, have been, like, I'd say, they would like to say they live half the year there. I think it's more like 9 months. So we go all the time.
So what do they think of chicha?
They love it. They love it, which is like such a relief because, you know, parents can be so hard. And it's interesting that they really enjoy it because we've taken some dishes, like our abajo is, we took in the traditional way of cooking this pork dish and plantain leaves and steaming it, but then we interpreted it in a different way. And I'm surprised that they love it. They think it's their favorite dish. It's actually like a lot of people's favorites.
Your parents are okay that you took a few liberties
with
it. That's good. That's good. What else is on the menu that is a must order?
Must orders are the elotitos, which are fresh baby corn, which you don't see anywhere, and they're just delicious. I think people always
baby corn like you used to see in like Chinese food restaurants?
Yes. So that's what I was about to say. Like everyone picture is this canned baby corn as like the extra vegetable in your whatever Chinese dish.
And your mixed vegetables.
Yeah. Like cut up into little pieces. So that's not what we're doing. We get the fresh baby corn in its little husk. You peel it and it's so cute. It's
like, I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah. And it's crazy. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to get. We have one purveyor for it. But we just peel them, we grill them, and serve them over popcorn and some chipotle sauce and a cilantro aioli as well. And it's just like a perfect sharing, dunking dish to have with friends.
How much fun? Can you only get that baby corn when it's corn season, obviously?
We just opened in May. I'm hoping that it'll continue. But, you know, we're going to change up our menu as the fall comes around and stuff.
Okay. So you're co-owner and culinary director. What does that mean?
So I own it with three other partners, my husband being one, and then our beverage director, Marshall, and another person, another friend named Nate. And so we all do it together. Marshall's really in charge of the beverage section because that's not my specialty.
Tell us your day-to-day. Like, what are you always running around doing?
So my day-to-day, I get there pretty early. I like to have the restaurant to myself in the morning. You've owned a restaurant, so there's a lot of paperwork, which is kind of crazy. So I take care of that. And then our chef comes in and he starts, you know, making some specials, trying that, checking in some orders that come in throughout the day. And then 5 o'clock rolls around really quickly. My son comes to the restaurant. We go to the kitchen. He has to have his tortillas and his queso. Like, so we go in there and we talk to the chef and everything. And
how old is your son?
2 years old. He knows everyone's name. It's so cute. It's like, I don't know what's more of a dream, like having the restaurant or having him like grow up in the restaurant. It's so cute. And he just loves food. He eats whatever. It's amazing. And then we'll sit at the bar. you know, talk with customers, walk around. There's a lot of Nicaraguans that have been coming out solely because they Google Nicaraguan restaurant and we're the only thing that's coming up. So we've had such a great Nicaraguan turnout. We have this drink called Bluefield Swizzle, and Bluefield is a place on the East Coast. Small, like that area is very remote, and we've had groups of family come from there. Every night, I would say there's like three different groups of Nicaraguans. So a lot of my time is spent talking with them, and just they're so proud to have this restaurant. I'm so happy to have them there, and just kind of creating this community. It's been awesome.
I am going to take a quick break for a few words from our sponsors, and then I have a few more questions for you when we come back. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplome, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that has been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today. All right, we are back with Vanessa Palacio. She is the owner and culinary director of Chicha, a new restaurant in Bushwick, here in Brooklyn, not too far away from the radio station. And I want all of you to go visit it as soon as possible. So, Vanessa, given everything that is in the news right now with the whole family separation tragedy that's going on, you know, being the daughter of immigrants and a mom, I just can't imagine what you're thinking.
I mean, it's awful. It's hard to even picture like people doing this and being a mom also. I think that's where it really hits home. It's just, I just can't see like children being separated from parents. It's just, it's heartbreaking.
Do you know what, have your parents ever talked to you about their journey here? Why they came here? They came here?
Yeah. Politically they had to come here. It's kind of an awful story. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to be here. And it took a while, not to make light of this, but like I'd be growing up and my mom's like, if you get married to a gringo, I'm not going to like your kids and stuff like that. So it took a while for her to like warm up to having to be in this country. And now she's so happy. Like we have a great education and we've got so many opportunities here. So it was interesting because I think most people are happy to be coming to this country, and my parents were upset to be leaving their place and not being able to go back.
Were they refugees or did they seek asylum here?
They moved here. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So how long was it before they could go back? Do you know?
13 years.
Wow. That's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad your parents are safe and happy and able to go back and forth now.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had no idea you were a mom.
Yeah, a mom of a 2-year-old son and two large dogs, a husky Rottweiler mix and a yellow lab.
And they are not allowed in the restaurant.
No.
As we all know here in New York, because the health department will get you in trouble for that one. All right, so anything else we should know about Chicha?
Definitely come by. We have a lot of other traditional dishes. We're starting brunch soon, and we're going to have one of my favorite dishes called vigorón, which is yuca, a cabbage slaw, and chicharrón. Please, we'd love to see you.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much. And again, thank you for putting up with the chaos earlier, but wishing you tons of success
with
the restaurant, and I can't wait to visit.
Yay.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back with our Anthony Bourdain tribute after a few words from our sponsors. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and pâtisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplome and graduate into a world of opportunity. You can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best foodie cities out there. London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. It's time for our Bob's Red Mill Minute. One of my personal favorite summertime recipes actually comes from the back of a package of Bob's Red Mill quinoa that I had found a few years ago. I don't know what it is about back of package recipes, but for some reason I never trusted them. And then I saw this recipe and I was like, huh, this sounds like something I can wrap my head around. And that's even though I grew up making like Toll House cookies, you know, forever as a kid. That's the most famous back of the package recipe. Anyway, the recipe is for quinoa tabbouleh. It's not exactly traditional tabbouleh, but stick with me. You can use Bob's Red Mill, any of the Bob's Red Mill quinoas, and their quinoa is great for so many reasons. It's organic, kosher, gluten-free, vegan, and whole grain, so a lot of territory is covered there. And a nice thing about quinoa is that it cooks in no time. It's really hard to screw up, and you can make a big batch days in advance, and it won't get dry or weird. I've modified the recipe a lot over the years. It calls for, I'm going to look at the recipe right now, calls for quinoa, of course, parsley, scallions, tomatoes, mint, garlic, basil, lemon juice, extra virgin olive oil, salt, and white pepper. I don't know why white pepper, but you can use whatever pepper you want. I do love garlic, but sometimes I find raw garlic is a bit too much, especially if you're making it ahead. And I don't put tomatoes in if I'm making it a few days ahead of time either, because I hate a mushy tomato, and so should you. But it is nice to make a little bit ahead of time, at least an hour, so the flavors can all kind of marinate. And don't be afraid to just kind of do what you want with this. If you have certain herbs, use them. If you don't have certain herbs, don't worry about it. It's really a fun one to mix and match. You can find the recipe for quinoa tabbouleh on bobsredmill.com. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today. All right, so back to our programming. We have a few special guests calling in. I need to check with our producer, Vitor, our engineer, Vitor. We're good? Okay. Vitor, tell me who we have. Helen on the phone?
Hi. Yeah,
hi.
I'm here.
How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Carrie. How are you?
Great. So everybody, we have Helen Rosner on the phone. She is a contributing writer at The New Yorker and wrote a really terrific piece about Anthony Bourdain the other week. And I asked Helen if she would come on and just talk to us for a little bit about her feelings about Bourdain. She had the privilege of interviewing him a few times. So Helen, how did you first meet Bourdain?
You know, the first time we met in person was actually when I interviewed him for the Eater Upsell, which is a podcast where I used to be one of the hosts. Though we corresponded for a long time before then, I think he, followed me on Twitter many years ago, and over the years we would send each other Twitter DMs and kind of graduated to just texting, mostly like gossip and hello and I liked your story and things like that. And it was a real pleasure to finally get to spend time face to face with him in a room, in front of a microphone, talking about what at the time he was promoting his cookbook, Appetites, which he co-wrote with Laurie Wolever. And it was a real sort of milestone publication for him. I think that, you know, he had spent so much of his year distancing himself from his role as a cook, and really making the case that he wasn't a cook. He was an observer of the culinary world. And then to publish a book about home cooking, which was informed so much by his role as a father and his relationship to his daughter. It was really a lovely experience. We talked for almost 2 hours, and somehow our editor got it down to an hour-ish long podcast.
I want to hear the unedited version of that. What was he like in person, Helen?
He's tall. I think that's the first thing that I always think to say when folks ask me what he's like. He is a tall man, and he's sort of got a strong physical presence. There are certain people, when they walk into a room, they kind of are a vortex of charisma, and he certainly was one of those folks. I imagine that a lot of that was simply the sheer quantity of his celebrity, but he was kind and engaging, and he saw everyone, you know, the producers and the sound engineers, or if you ran into him at a party, you know, he's the kind of person who makes eye contact, who says hello. He really makes a point of making sure that you feel known. And I think that was a key part of his success as a writer and as a television personality and as a sort of person in the world. He really made everybody he spoke to feel like he could see them. And that's a really wonderful way to become part of people's lives.
Your story is titled Anthony Bourdain and the Power of Telling the Truth. Why did he have such an easy time telling the truth when so many people in the food world don't? They just stay neutral. They stay silent.
Oh, that's such a good question. We could probably come up with a lot of different hypotheses for these, but something that always stuck with me in my time knowing him was something that he said in that first interview, which was that he became famous in the middle of his life. He didn't achieve this extraordinary fame until he was in his 40s. And he really felt that because fame came to him late, he had less to prove. He had fewer people to fear. I think he was very confident in who he was, in both a sort of fundamentally existential way, and also in terms of his celebrity and his creative life and the trajectory of all of his work. You know, the most people who are afraid to speak up, well, it's because you're afraid, right? Mm-hmm. It comes from a place of fear. And I think that Tony was afraid of almost nothing, including things that were about his own life and his own future and his own trajectory. He knew that he would like himself more in the morning if he went down for being honest as opposed to staying up for being quiet.
I never had the privilege of meeting him, but that was my impression. I just felt like he was fearless and was totally okay to wake up every morning and come out swinging in defense of those who needed that. Can you tell us about the... go ahead. Sorry, Helen.
Oh, I was going to say that I think that in so many ways, that's one of the biggest losses. As a person and as a father and as a friend and as a writer and creator, there's, of course, tremendous loss in all of that. But he also was, in so many ways, the moral weather vane of the food world and someone who had a huge platform, probably a bigger platform than anybody else in the culinary community, and did not hesitate to call out bad actors or to point out ridiculousness or to elevate people who he thought were sort of being insufficiently appreciated. There are so many things that have happened in the barely 2 weeks since he's died that I feel like he would have been able to just shoot down with a cleverly worded tweet. And it's a real loss for all of us to not have that moral compass.
It is. I think I've had a lot of moments where I just think, God, what would Anthony Bourdain say right now? And yeah, I think that's one of the things, for me, that's the biggest thing, that he just was so unafraid to speak out. And so many people right now are afraid to speak out. And we kind of lost our big voice in this industry. I wanted to talk about, you had a very interesting conversation with him about feminism. Can you, for people who didn't read your story yet, I don't want to give away the end of your story, but can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, you know, so over the course of our acquaintance, Tony and I talked a lot, both on and off the record, about all sorts of things, and we frequently came back to the topic of politics and activism and the ways that we sort of align ourselves as human beings in the world with forces of change. And, you know, if you were a follower of his show, you were definitely sort of clued into certain aspects of the politics that he espoused, right? That he was definitely a person who was skeptical of war and skeptical of government and skeptical of oligarchy and skeptical of capital and very much in favor of like health and safety and security for people in the working class and the lower class and elevating people out of poverty and things that are generally very much in line with a sort of liberal and progressive worldview. During a conversation that we had that was for an interview, a feature interview that ran on Eater.com back in December of 2016, he and I actually had dinner. It was the night that the Electoral College certified Donald Trump as the winner of the 2016 election. And he and I went out for yakitori and beers in the west side of Manhattan, and we sat at a table and sort of lamented the state of America, but also I asked him what he thought was going to be happening, because he, by that point in his life, had, I think, was sort of indisputably an expert on the way that nations can change and the way that who's running the show can affect the lives of the people on the ground. And one of the questions that I asked him after we had talked about all sorts of things was kind of a point blank thing. I said, listen, are you a feminist? Do you think of yourself as a feminist? And he was kind of struck by the question, I think by me putting it so bluntly. And he gave me a very roundabout answer. He spent a lot of time kind of talking about how he, of course, aligned himself with fundamental principles of feminism, that he recognized and was outraged by the plight of women and by the sort of corresponding offenses of homophobia and homophobic culture, which are so closely aligned with feminism, and that he unequivocally supported reproductive rights, and that he absolutely believed that the wage gap needed to be addressed and that women were exactly as capable as men at all sorts of things. I mean, just a litany of agreement with the principles of feminism. And then at the end, he kind of pulled back and said, I don't know if that makes me a feminist. Doesn't that just make me a New Yorker? Doesn't that just make me a person in the world who understands that other people are people too? And we kind of left it there. And then, of course, over the last year and a half, the world has changed dramatically in a number of ways. And one of the very big ones was that the Me Too movement arose. And one of the most prominent voices in that was Asia Argento, who was Tony's girlfriend, the actor and filmmaker who has been incredibly outspoken about her sexual assault at the hands of Harvey Weinstein and has been one of the most loud and focused voices on not letting this topic drop. And Tony became a real champion, both of her and of the Me Too movement. And the last time that I saw him before his death, which was several months ago, he kind of grabbed me by the shoulder as I was walking past him at a party. And, we had said hello earlier and stuff like that. And we, of course, had spoken extensively in the interim, but in the months between that interview and the party. And he said, hey, remember that time that we were sitting in that restaurant and you asked me if I was a feminist and I was afraid to say yes? And I was like, yeah, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And he, was really serious and he looked me right in the eye and said, write this down. I'm a fucking feminist. In that moment, I was thinking to myself, God, this is going to make a great kicker to a story someday. And I never, ever thought that it was going to end up being an obituary. But that was who he was. He was a person who always looked for growth. He always wanted to learn more. He was so receptive to being shown the error of his ways and given opportunities to become stronger and truer and to see truer truths. It was an amazing and unexpectedly moving moment that I've really carried with me.
Well, Helen, thank you so much for writing the story that you did, because I think it was exactly what a lot of us needed to read in the days after his passing. So Helen Rosner from The New Yorker, thank you for joining us. Be sure to check out Helen's story online, Anthony Bourdain and the Power of Telling the Truth. Take care, Helen.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks.
I'm going to read a few comments from Instagram that I just think are particularly compelling. We had posted about the show earlier and told people that they could leave their remembrances of Anthony Bourdain. And to be honest, I didn't think we would get so many comments. So I'm sorry just to read a few, but please continue to post. I think, he meant so many things to so many of us. And as part of the mourning process, it's just helpful to read how other people felt and just to know that, you weren't alone in your feelings for him. A woman whose handle is aqua_lamb, Stephanie Dietz. She is the chef owner of Dominion VA, a donut shop in Virginia. She writes, I'm gutted over the loss of Anthony Bourdain. As a 22-year-old aspiring line cook, I soaked up every word of Kitchen Confidential and moved to New York City because that's where Tony said it was the best place to be a chef. Through reading his books, I gained confidence and felt I belonged too, which could be difficult when you're the only girl in the kitchen. I met him in 2010 at the Medium Raw book signing, and he told me to absorb as much information as possible that would help me become a better cook. I did just that, working for a catering company, worked at a small restaurant, taught cooking classes. Fast forward to 27, and I moved back to my hometown to open a donut shop. I really don't think any of this would have happened had I not read Kitchen Confidential. I will forever be grateful for Anthony and everything he showed us. Also, let's see, we also have Andrew Kahar. Andrew wrote, Anthony Bourdain helped me pay more attention to not only what my mother was making in the kitchen all those years growing up, how her cooking was informed by her past, but to the immense diversity and wealth of food I had to choose from in my own backyard of Cleveland, Ohio, if I knew where and how to look. His work inspired me to rediscover my city and see it in a new light. In a new light, right as I was becoming a little disillusioned by it, and for that, I'll be forever grateful. The joy there is to find in good food, and what it means to share it with someone else is invaluable. Hopefully, I can pass that on to the next person looking for a better meal. All right, the next caller we have on the phone is a friend of Cherry Bomb's, Cha McCoy. Cha, can you hear us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Cha, how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
So Cha was on the show a few weeks ago. Hopefully a lot of you heard the show. She is studying to be a sommelier. She is a travel expert and consultant and all those good things. And Cha, when I heard that Anthony passed away, weirdly, you were one of the first people who popped in my mind. I was like, because we were talking about wanderlust and just sort of satisfying that need we have in so many of us to travel the world. And you're somebody who's actually just picked up and done that. And he passed away. And I was just like, God, I wonder how Cha's feeling today. I feel like she lost like a fellow wanderluster. How are you doing?
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I feel like I'm an escapist. And I think that happens when you travel so often, you go to where a place that makes you feel better, so you can kind of like move on. So I think I immediately, after trying to mourn for a day, and I have never met Anthony Bourdain, but his influence in what I do and what I've done is definitely there and present in my life. So I had to kind of step back out of it and kind of, like what you said earlier, you know, what would Anthony do in this situation? You know, if his hero passed away, if his, you know, his muse is not there, like what would he do? And I think that, you know, I felt honored that she thought to even reach out to me. Besides explaining to my mother who passed away, you know, I said, oh man, my Uncle Tony's gone. And she's like, Uncle who? You know, so then just having to get people to understand who are not in either the travel industry or not familiar with the show or even in the hospitality world, you know, they just, you know, kind of, it was just a normal day and another person who passed away that's famous was for some of us. And I actually had a talk with, which was spot on when you contacted me. I was literally having a conversation about his death with Chef Clancy the moment that you actually texted me about this episode. So I thought that was kind of surreal too, as at the same time to kind of be invited to talk on this topic as well. So
what do you think his influence will be on the food world ultimately?
I hope it opens the minds of many people. Like, you know, I look at it, actually was incidents in this world as a chef first and from hospitality, me coming as a traveler first and then now entering into hospitality. I hope that everybody, besides just, you know, being inspired to take a trip to somewhere that's kind of like off the beaten path, dig a little deeper, I would say, especially to industry, they understand a lot of things that were mentioned from the person who actually knew him. Like, don't be afraid of the world. Go to those places that are kind of like not the shiny places that everyone's speaking about, you know, whether it's the new trendy places, et cetera. Don't be afraid to learn something new when you're there. Challenge your own art, you know, whether it's, you know, pastry chef, whatever you're putting out there, I hope that most people are taken from him, you know, and I guess even from the, as he describes himself to the writer that just spoke, you know, as an observer, I hope people saw through his lens that, you know, maybe you really do got to go on some long boat ride in the middle of Vietnam to kind of get some traditional herbs, et cetera. Like, it's okay, you know, be a little dangerous, like, be a little open-minded to that. And then for people who are kind of on the borderline, you know, about who they should support, what they should support, especially if there's not a category they fit into, for example, highlighting minority chefs, whether it's female chefs, LGBTQ chefs, you know, but yet realizing their talent, but clearly realizing that no one is putting them at the forefront because of these boxes that they're kind of categorized in, you know, hopefully other chefs kind of reach out. You know, I hope this is the legacy people take from him. Like, that's what I took, and I think that's what his show spoke to the most. And I think that even if you even read the book or watch any of his episodes of the show, his bluntness was a example of just kind of how he wants everyone. And that goes back to being a New Yorker. Like, I'm a New Yorker, so I know what it feels like. I didn't take this as, oh, just some random person died. I realized even when I think New York One actually interviewed one of my favorite restaurants in Chinatown, the owner talking in the neighbor, he's crying on the news about, you know, Tony's left us, you know, kind of thing, because you actually feel connected with him. His spirit seems that way, you know, without even me having to meet him, you could tell that he left his presence there. And it's funny because I didn't even realize that was one of his restaurants here in New York City until I seen it on New York. I was already going there with my family. So, But I think he left that around the small mom and pop restaurants that don't get noted for having the best of whatever, that another restaurant opens up and get a Michelin star for basically recreating what that small restaurant's been doing for two decades, three decades already. You know, I feel like that's what the show put out there too. Like, go support those people, you know, the people who actually have been doing it, that, you know, whether they're immigrants into America and brought it to a particular neighborhood. You know, his show, when he spent time in Queens and Bronx, et cetera, it's on purpose. You know, he doesn't have to, like, travel to the new trendy places. He feels like highlighting where he's from and showcasing New York was a big deal. And so as a New Yorker, I definitely took pride in that. But at the same time, you know, explore where you're at. You know, you don't have to go to Italy. You can literally go to the actual Italian-owned or Mexican-owned restaurants and be able to know about traditions. And I'm sure someone in the chefs in the kitchen will be happy to give you the same kind of tutorials that you spend all this money and lavish vacation trips on to kind of fly to Italy and have experiences. You know, it's like some of them you can have where you at. And I think I like that part of the show too. It was a reality check for me.
Exactly.
You know, I dealt a lot with culture shock when I moved back from Italy because I didn't want to be back in America. Like, I wanted to live the life I lived in Italy, and unfortunately I was back in America. And his show was one of those things that kept me going. I still feel connected to the world. You have the opportunity to kind of be connected to a bunch of cultures, you know, all over. One restaurant.
Cha, I'm going to stop you right there because I think we're losing you a little bit. But thank you so much. You know, you and I will connect later. But we appreciate you sharing your thoughts about Anthony Bourdain. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye, Cha. I'm going to read one more Instagram post, then we're going to talk to Chef Preeti Mistry. From Maureen McCloskey, she writes, "One thing I learned from Anthony, that is for sure, there is nothing more human, more gratifying, more intimate than sitting down to a meal together. The undeniable unifier of our existence is food. It brings us together, heals us, and fuels us in ways that surpass just nutritional value. He taught us that the world can be a kinder place with the power of cooking and sharing a meal. I think many of us know the silencing power depression has. We're inundated with the if you're struggling, speak up message, which is a wildly unrealistic possibility when you feel like you're drowning. The best way I can think of honoring this incredible man's legacy is to reach out, set the table, and care for others through food, often and with intention." All right, we have Chef Preeti Mistry on the line. Preeti, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. Chef Preeti Mistry is a good friend of Cherry Bomb. A lot of you know her. You've seen her in the magazine, at our conferences. You've heard our interviews with her. Preeti had a Juhu Beach Club in Oakland, and she is currently the chef of Navi Kitchen, also in Oakland. But Preeti had the honor, I'll say the honor, of being on Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown. I forget what season, but just look up the San Francisco Bay Area Oakland episode. It's on. You can watch it on Netflix right now. But Preeti, how did you wind up on the show?
I mean, first and foremost, I have to thank John Bergsall, food writer, and James Beard, award winner. John Bergsall was the one who actually had started having a conversation with Tony about coming to the Bay Area. And John recommended a number of businesses. The show itself was about sort of the changing Bay Area in terms of what technology and the influx of money that comes with technology was doing to the food scene and the art scene, et cetera. And obviously people of color, folks with less money. John is the one who recommended that he come to Juno Beach Club as the antidote, I believe, to the grotesque tech money of San Francisco.
It was interesting. I rewatched the episode last night, and I'd forgotten just how much he focused on sort of the real gritty, let your freak flag fly part of the Bay Area, which was nice because I've always loved that part of the city. And, you know, with so much of the focus being on the tech world now, that's not only lost, but, you know, it's clearly being driven out of the city. So tell me what it was like. What was the taping like?
I mean, I'll be totally honest, and I think I mentioned this on social media days after the news broke about him dying, and that was that, you know, I was very skeptical. You know, I've been in this industry for 15 plus, almost 20 years, and I didn't know if, you know, this very intelligent, charismatic guy who's on TV, who I loved all of his shows, and have read many of his books, was going to be just another bro-y jerk in person. I didn't have any sort of delusions. Luckily I was very surprised by his presence. And, you know, I mean, I was very nervous, but ultimately I was just concerned that that we wouldn't have a good rapport, that he wouldn't get me. And I was so, you know, amazed. You know, he spent a lot of time in India. He knows a lot about Indian food. But the one thing, and I think Helen kind of touched on this as well, is that he, no matter how much he traveled or knew about a particular region or country, he never came across as that sort of arrogant, all of a sudden, a couple times, you know, and I think that was something that really struck me, is his continued humbleness in conversation with hardworking people that are making the food of their heritage, et cetera. So, you know, were there certain things where I said, you probably know about, you know, bel puri or, you know, this chicken or that certain dish. And of course he was like, oh, yeah. But it wasn't met with, you know, which I am often met with, people who, like I said, have been to India or wherever, Edison, New Jersey, and think they know everything about Indian cuisine, or had that friend in college. And he was just earnestly wanted to take in what was going on. There were a number of moments on the show that didn't, make the actual cut. I remember there was one point I was telling him about one of our dishes and explaining that all of the vegetables in that dish were grown about 30 miles east. And the farmer was actually one of our servers who was working that night, it's her second job. And, you know, he just kind of stopped and he looked at John and he was like, this is what farm to table really is. Like, I don't know what the fuck all these people are talking about. And, you know, whatever. Food is grown on a farm, you eat it on a table.
And served by the farmer on top of that. I wish that had made it in.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, he sort of was kind of commenting on, you know, because I don't use those words. That's just how we cook here in California, or at least how I cook. But, you know, he was sort of commenting on this buzzword that has sort of overtaken the industry of farm to table, and was like, wait a minute, this is actually what it really should mean, and only this, and not, you know, all these other sort of appropriations.
Preeti, what do you hope his legacy is?
What's that?
What do you hope his legacy is ultimately?
I really hope that people see that, you know, he was loved by just about everyone. When I told people that we were going to be on that show, it wasn't like half the people I talked to were like, who? From, you know, 8 years old to 80 plus, people knew who he was. And I hope that what they take away from that is really that he was such a person that seemed to have a sort of insatiable curiosity. And it was always met with, again, this sort of, it was a humble curiosity. It wasn't a, it came from a place of respect for, you know, the cooks, the dishwashers, the farmers, the servers, the hardworking people, respect for people's traditions and culture and heritage. And to have a reverence for that and have the same level of reverence from that, you know, roadside stand in India or Vietnam or that taco truck in Fruitvale in Oakland that he would for a 20-course Michelin-starred meal. And I hope that, that people in our industry who are often become so jaded and focused on the upper echelons really take that in, because I think that was something that made him such a true champion of just all people who are doing good things, and then not just those that are in the limelight.
Absolutely. Well, Preeti, thank you so much. And like I mentioned, you can find the episode that Preeti's on Netflix, the Anthony Bourdain Parts Unknown seasons. I think there are 8 or 9 seasons on there right now, so you can go back and watch them. But Preeti, thank you. It's good to hear your voice.
Thanks, Carrie.
Take care. All right, I'm just going to read a quick passage before we wrap up the show. I know a lot of us are looking to Anthony's writings to try to find some solace, to try to find some answers about what happened, and I thought this was particularly moving. It's from Kitchen Confidential, and it's actually the afterword, so if you have an early edition of the book, you don't have this, but he did, he corrected a lot of, not a lot, but some things he got wrong. Both factually and, I don't know, emotionally in the original issue. So I'm just going to read this. Another correction. In the rather pompous last line of the About the Author graph on the final page, oh God, I don't know if I'm going to be able to read this. Ugh. I added that I would live and will always live in New York City. That didn't turn out to be exactly true. I don't really live anywhere anymore. Already a man without a country. I'm home maybe 4 or 5 nights a month and travel for one reason or another, upwards of 10 or 11 months out of the year. So maybe I've already left. Though I will always carry New York City around in my heart, I don't know if I can fully relax and enjoy living there full time anymore. Having been captivated in strange and wonderful ways by Asia, Southeast Asia in particular, I don't know if I can relax and fully enjoy myself there either, to be honest. I once felt safe and at home in the kitchen. I knew the rules, or thought I knew the rules. It was a life of absolutes, of certainties, and that comforted me. That comforted me in a way nothing since has. Like a lot of chefs, I'm less sure of myself outside the kitchen. Since all of my dreams came true, I've had to make adjustments. I've had to make them every day. My people skills, beyond telling them what to do or being told what to do and taking shit and talking shit, not taking shit, and talking shit, weren't the best after 28 plus years in the life. They still aren't. It says something about me, I think, that I'm most at ease these days, at my most relaxed, when alone in the smoking room of an airport lounge. Coming from somewhere nice and on my way to another. Sorry to be a crybaby, but if you listen to the show, you know I'm a Pisces and I cry a lot. All right. Music playing innocuously in the background, a nice orderly itinerary in one hand,
telling me what to do, when to do it, and where. A drink or a cigarette in the other, and I'm good. I'm free, as it were, of the complications of normal human entanglements, untormented by the beauty, complexity, and challenge of a big, magnificent, and awful painful world. Human behavior remains a mystery to me. Anthony Bourdain, Bali, 2006. Okay, well, anyway, you could tell he meant a lot to me. One last thing I want to add. His birthday is on June 25th, and I think it would be, and this wasn't my idea, I heard someone else say this, but it's definitely a great way to honor him, to go to a restaurant in your neighborhood that you've never been to before, especially a cuisine you've never tried before. Talk to the owner, find out how they started their restaurant, why they started the restaurant, take a picture of the food, share it on Instagram, use social media for good, and honor Bourdain's legacy at the same time. So that's it for today's show. Thank you to Vanessa Palacio, Helen Rosner, Jeff Pudimistri, and Sean McCoy. Thank you to our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill, the best friend of every baker we know, and Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. You can subscribe to our show wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can subscribe to Cherry Bomb Magazine at cherrybomb.com. Our theme song is by the band Tralala. Thanks to our engineer, Vitor. Vitor, thank you. You were a good sport today. You put up with a lot and handled all that tech stuff. Our phone system crashed earlier, too, so it's been quite the day. One last thing to add. Suicide is so sad and so awful. If any of you are having a hard time, I know how hard it is to reach out, but each and every one of you is so important. You're all part of the Bomb Squad, and we need all of you. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. You are the bomb.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.